Blog Talk Radio.
Hello out there. My name is Sam Maxwell, and welcome to the Bedford & Sullivan Podcast, the podcast that keeps you, the audience, active listeners in the research process of the Brooklyn Dodgers TV series I am developing. Today, I am very, very happy to welcome somebody who is just gone on and on about the Brooklyn Dodgers, probably knows as much about the Brooklyn Dodgers as anybody out there. It's Flatbush native, Alan Newmark. How you doing, Alan?
Good morning, Sam. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Thank you very, very much for joining. And Alan and I know each other through a summer camp all the way up on a farm way up in Earlton called Tranquility Camp. His children went there, and he now does stuff with the alumni, the Tranquility, Friends of Tranquility, as it is now called. And in the tradition of Tranquility and the community it fosters, Alan, it's come on to help me with this research process. We call it noblesse oblige. It's something that our old lady Pearl always said, if you're noble, you are obliged to be noble. And that is what Alan is doing for me right now. But, Alan, I know you and I could get into a rant about Tranquility Camp, and most people won't know what we're talking about. So let's head down the thruway, through the Bronx and Queens, all the way on the Brooklyn Queens Expressway all the way to Brooklyn, and tell me about your Brooklyn roots.
Well, I was born in Brooklyn. It was called the Bethel Hospital. It's called the Brook something or other today. We lived in East Flatbush. For 1 year, we did live upstate New York, and for a short time, we lived in Minnesota, believe it or not. And it was too cold for my mother. And we came back, and we went right back to East Flatbush, and that's where I was brought up.
Now, what brought you to Minneapolis, or not Minneapolis?
Oh, my father's business. My father was a vice president of a milk company, and this was during the Second World War. And he made the deals with the farmers. You know, people think the milk comes right, you know, locally. It does sometimes, but sometimes it has to come from other places. And apparently he would sign the farmers to a deal. And so we lived in a hotel, actually, in Minnesota for, I don't know, 7 months or so. We lived upstate for 1 year, and that's where a lot of the farms were. And it's a place not too far from Binghamton.
Okay.
Actually, so
off that,
which is interesting because two of my children went to Binghamton.
Well, it all comes back around. That, you know, life is odd like that, but it all comes back around.
Right.
In terms of just a briefly tangent, what I've noticed, I do see New Jersey on a lot of the milk that we buy from the delis these days. But you know, it certainly isn't as local as it used to be. But it's interesting. It's certainly interesting to bring that up. I hadn't even thought about that whole Minnesota aspect.
Sam, did you know that people used to not go to the grocery to get milk? It actually was delivered to the home.
I do know that.
In bottles, in glass bottles, which is so much more, so much healthier than in cartons.
Mm-hmm.
Or in plastic.
Well, tell me about some time in terms of that the olden days. Tell me about some of your memories of living in East Flatbush and rooting for the Brooklyn Dodgers.
I was always and still am. I was very always interested in subways and trolleys and in buses, and I was always interested in that thing. And of course, I was mostly interested in baseball. My thoughts, even in school, were always on baseball, and I would always, you know, be anxious to get home to listen to a ball game or to see it on television. Most of the games were played when I was young during the day. I think the Dodgers schedule used to have 22-day night games the entire year. You never played a night game on Saturday or Sunday, for sure. And so most of the games were day games. And I used to run home, and when I was, in elementary school, I lived like three blocks from the school, and I would go home and listen to Red Barber, Connie Desmond. I even had the pleasure of hearing the first broadcast by Vince Scully. Red Barber introduced Vince Scully. Barber had been the Dodger announcer at that point for about 11 years. He came out of Cincinnati, where he was the announcer for a few years in Cincinnati. And he introduced Vince Scully by saying, "This is the old redhead, and I want to bring in the young redhead." And he did that in 1950. And, of course, Vinny's still been there, still there. Going to do it again next year, I think, for the last time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was, and I wanted to be that. I said, you know, I knew I couldn't be a ball player. I wasn't that good. And although it broke my heart to admit that. I was a better softball player. I could hit
Vince
about
Scully.
A softball. I couldn't hit a baseball, though.
Well, generally speaking, I mean, talking about tranquility, that's where we hone our softball skills.
That's right. That's right. That's true. I know they do that. But I used to play in a schoolyard. We had a short right field wall, and I was a right-handed batter, but I knew I could hit to all fields. And I knew how to hit that wall, and I'm telling you, I batted about 800. I batted about 800. I used to hit second.
No, wait, you're a lefty or a righty?
No, I'm a righty.
What wall was that
again?
Righty,
but I was able to go to, you know, I was like the young David Wright. Not quite as good looking. But anyway, I would travel to Ebbets Field. You know, we didn't go very often when I was young. I would take a trolley. The Church Avenue trolley, which incidentally was the last trolley to run in Brooklyn. Brooklyn was full of trolleys. That's how the Dodgers got their name, the Trolley Dodgers. Prior to that, they were called the Robins and the Super Bass, and they had all kinds of names. They were called the Robins because of the manager, Wilbur Robinson, who managed from 1914 to 1934. And anyway, it would take the trolley car, the Church Avenue trolley car, to a bus and get off at Empire Boulevard, walk over two blocks, and there it was. You know, it was like I can't even explain how exciting it was. You'd walk in, and you go through the rotunda, which they tried to imitate at Citi Field, but it's nothing, believe me, like the real rotunda was at Ebbets Field, and you walked in and you could smell the grass. Now, you got to understand that I was brought up, we lived in a very nice apartment building, and most of the people I knew either lived in apartment buildings or we did have a lot of private homes.
So you might have mentioned this. I'm looking at the map right now of Brooklyn and East Flatbush. You might have said this, but I just want to get the corner. Where is your apartment building again?
East 54th and Clarkson. It's now all Caribbean, and it's still very nice. As nice as it was 60 years ago.
Okay. All right. So, and you would take the Church Avenue trolley over to Bedford Avenue?
No, it would take it over, I think, to Rogers Avenue. You'd get a bus on Rogers Avenue, and it would take you to Empire Boulevard and walk over, I think it was two blocks, and you'd get to Ebbets Field. Or somebody would drive us, some father or mother, and just drop us off.
Yeah, you were basically right there. Did you ever walk walk over to that direction?
It was kind of a long walk. I was kind of a lazy guy. I don't remember walking. Maybe, but I doubt it. I can't remember that. I think my first game was like in 1950. So, but I remember, I'm telling you, when you walked in, you looked at the grass. It was so, I mean, how much grass did I see? I mean, people had these little private homes, had little patches of grass, but you didn't smell the grass. And when you walked in the ballpark, you smelled the Frankfurters. I mean, I think they were like 15 cents or something like that. And, I mean, they didn't have sushi. And, which is, you know, I mean, you came to the game, you had a Frankfurter and a soda. It probably cost you a quarter. The seats, the bleacher seats were 75 cents, and the general admission tickets were a dollar and a quarter. I still have some of the receipts from those times.
Speaking of a little bit of you were saying about sushi and modern baseball, when you mentioned Vince Scully, I just wanted to get this point out. I think that Vince Scully is the best in the business, and the ones that are just under him are the three, Gary, Keith, and Ron, in terms of the television broadcast. I don't think anybody else compares to those two at the top.
Oh, then you're absolutely right, and you got to include Howie Rose in there.
Of course.
I've been to 34 major league ballparks. Some of them, like Ebbets Field, are gone, and we have some more to do. This year we went to Atlanta, and I want to tell you something. Nothing. My wife, who's younger than I am, was brought up in the Bronx and she'd obviously never experienced Ebbets Field. And we went to Chicago a few years ago and to Wrigley Field. And she loves that. That's her favorite ballpark. Mm. And I would try to explain to her, it's nothing like Ebbets Field. I'm sure it is, but, you know, in my mind, it's nothing like Ebbets Field.
Right. Of course.
They're going to fix it up, and they're going to do something. They shouldn't do anything. The ballpark is perfect the way it is.
If you see the original original Ebbets Field before they added, in 1931, they added the left field, stands. The outfield used to be a lot bigger, and just because of it, all of these old parks had to be confined to a city block, which is one of the reasons why I thought the dimensions for City Field were so atrocious, because they were trying to get quirky. But the reason why all these places were quirky was because they were building in a city block, not because they were building in a parking lot. So I thought, the new dimensions are much, much more realistic and the way they should be.
Well, Ebbets Field had, down the right field line, was 297 feet, and the wall was 40 feet high. And I think after 20 feet, it became a screen. And if you hit it off the screen, you probably got a double out of it. And Duke Snider, who was one of my favorite players, said that if he had played at Yankee Stadium, he probably would have had at least another 100 home runs, because he was able to really, he had to lift the ball to get it over 40 feet high.
When you're talking Bedford Avenue home runs, though, that's what people talk about the Duke.
That's right. And across the street, there was the DeSoto Plymouth dealer. There's no more DeSoto Plymouth, and there's no dealer there anymore either.
No, it's the CVS and the Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Is that right?
Well, I'll tell you, I lived on Eastern Parkway and Rogers Avenue for about 2 or 3 years. And occasionally I'd have a day off and I'd walk over there in the middle of the day. For one thing, it was very surreal to, and I've told this story on air, so a lot of people might have heard it, but you haven't. I would stand in the middle, there's a playground right in the middle underneath the actual building, and it's just a weird feeling knowing that there used to be a ballpark there. And at Kentucky Fried Chicken, I remember saying something to one of the people there about how it's too bad that at least the facade of Ebbets Field isn't still there, and they didn't even know that there used to be a ballpark there.
I know. That's one of the reasons I don't like to go back there. But every time I'm on the Harlem River Drive going to New Jersey over the Washington Bridge, and we pass the Polo Grounds, I always point out to I always did. Now they don't ride with us anymore because they're big. My children, I say, you know, there used to be a ballpark here, and that's one of my favorite songs that Frank Sinatra sings. This is so true. There used to be a ballpark here. And although I only was in the Polo Grounds maybe four times, and only for the Mets, I certainly wouldn't go for the Giants. I mean, I was a Brooklyn guy. I mean, everybody I knew, except were Dodger fans, except for my friend's father, who was the nicest guy in the world when I think back on it. But I kind of hesitated liking him because he was a Giants fan. But he was really a nice man. I mean, he was always nice to me, especially. But he was a Giants fan. How could you be a Giants fan?
When you hear a lot of stories about, you know, initially people not getting along, but the human spirit always kind of just makes up for allegiances and rivals. There's a great Doris Kearns Goodwin story about her and a bakery, I believe. And when they were egging her on all 1951 as the Giants were coming close, and then, you know, she'd be always walking by there. She'd get a hot dog or something from them. They might have been a meat packing place, but and then obviously Bobby Thompson the home run happened and she stopped going there. And they sent like a big meat platter or something along those lines to her house and said, "Come back, redhead. We love you." Some sort of nickname. I haven't read the book in a while, but it's a really sweet story that you just hear. It's, like I said, it's the human spirit. Even though we're very, very passionate about our sports, we understand, or at least a good amount of us do, we understand that there's more to it, even though that brings a lot of great human characteristics out.
No, it's very true. It's amazing. I mean, I can't even describe to you what it was like to have. I mean, it meant to Brooklyn so much. The Dodgers were like, it was another religion. It was almost like another religion. In the years that I lived, those were the great years of the Dodgers. You know, from 47 to 57. What a time to be in New York, because
it was
only 1 year where a New York team didn't get to the World Series. That was 1948.
It's unbelievable to even fathom what it could have been like. And just to, before we get to some specifics about players, do you remember any time that you would go over to the ballpark on game day? Would you take the trip to the game, not to go in, but just to kind of linger around?
No, people didn't do that in those days, as far as I knew, because I was young. But no, if you went to the ballpark, you went to the game. I mean, it was one of those things. But
so the kids outside on Bedford Avenue, waiting for the Duke Snyder home runs, they were generally neighborhood kids.
They were neighborhood kids. You know, we lived up Montgomery Street. It was around that area there, I believe. You know, no, I didn't. I wasn't one of those. I never got a ball. I never got a ball. Did get a ball in Shea Stadium, but not. I was so interested in the players and the announcers, and I really wanted to be an announcer. I mean, I had a better voice in those days. I used to practice. I used to sit at a window in my. I lived on the third floor.
And speaking of which, you were telling me your memories about Tex Richards, the PA guy.
Oh, your PA guy. I'll tell you a story about the PA. You would walk. Yeah, the Dodgers had a PA announcer who would sit at the end of the dugout, outside the dugout. He wore a white sweater, even in the summertime, and it said Dodgers were sewed in the front of it. It was just the way their logo was, you know, the Dodgers in script. And he had this voice that was batting in number one position, and he had a Brooklyn accent. And he would say, instead of saying Cincinnati, he used to say Cincinnati, batting a number one position for Cincinnati. And he would do it only once through the lineup. If they had a pitching change, he would announce the pitching change. That's it. And one day, now I wasn't there, but I read this, and I remembered it as a kid. People would put their clothing, you know, like their jackets, on the railings out on the outfield. And one day he made an announcement. This is a true thing. And he said, "Will the people down the left field line please remove their clothing?" And he stopped. And that was, you know, typical Brooklyn, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's
interesting,
unbelievable, you know, stories.
I tell you another interesting thing about him. His name was Tex Rickard. Obviously, he probably had a different first name. The man running Madison Square Garden was named Tex Rickard, and he brought hockey. There was hockey played there 1 year in 1925. A New York American, somebody brought them, and they drew so well that Rickard said, "I got to bring a hockey team here," and he did. And when they went, they needed a nickname. They said they were Texas's Rangers, and that's how the New York Rangers became the New York Rangers. But he wasn't related. They weren't related at all.
Right. It is interesting, the stories about how these teams get their nicknames. In terms of Brooklyn and what you remember about other sports, what role did other sports play in not only your life in Brooklyn but other kids' life, just generally in the time?
Well, it was a different time where baseball was definitely number one. When I was in high school, I used to go with a GL card to some Ranger games. You know, you would sit for 50 cents or a dollar, and you could sit on the side arena. in the old Madison Square Garden, the one on 50th Street and 8th Avenue, you couldn't see if you sat too far back. You had to be like in the first row or on the end. The end was more money. So you had to get there early to see the whole ice. The basketball is a little better, but nobody came to see basketball. Basketball was not popular. The Knicks never sold out the old Madison Square Garden. They got big crowds late in the 60s, right before it closed and the new one opened. But it was always the Rangers. The Rangers always drew very well. The games didn't start, though, until about 8:30. But it was never, you never worried about getting on a subway and going home or, you know what I'm saying? Even the baseball games started later. I think the night game started at 8:30, if I remember correctly, and then they moved it to 8 o'clock.
Yeah, I think the first game actually was somewhere around the 9 o'clock time, where they probably they put the lights on. There, if I had it right in front of me, I'd tell you the exact time, because it has that, but it's somewhere in the 8 o'clock range. But they didn't.
Right.
Johnny Vandermeer didn't start pitching his no-hitter until around 9 o'clock.
Then
again, those games went a lot quicker.
Well, you know why they went quicker? Because you watch a game today, the batter steps out, he fixes his gloves, he comes back in, he is not happy, he goes out again. That wouldn't have happened those days. First of all, they didn't wear gloves. Second of all, if a hitter did that, the pitcher would throw right at his head, and he'd never do that again. Derek Jeter could not stand as close to the plate as he does. And you couldn't wear all that equipment, like armored equipment. He'd be on his backside more than he'd be standing up, because they didn't put up with that.
Remember about Barry Bonds, right before he retired, he was wearing that elbow pad, and he would just constantly get hit there, because
right.
I mean, everybody was pitching around him anyway.
And West Ham gets it like that. Also, Jeter, he stands right over the plate. A lot of them do. I mean, you couldn't do that then. They'd get brushed back. They used to call it a brush back pitch. But you were asking about other sports. So we would go to Knick games, yes. The Knicks were never very good when I was in high school. And I was always a big Knicks fan. But when I got older, right now, I'm a season ticket holder for the New York Rangers for the last 30-some-odd years.
Mm-hmm.
I love hockey. And I love baseball, of course. But, football was not very popular. It became very popular in that famous game between the Colts and the Giants in 1958. And it wasn't televised in New York, but I had the privilege, for the first time I went to Florida and actually saw the game in Florida. And that's how that turned the National Football League, and it became a very popular sport because people learned they can bet on it. Any sport you can bet on becomes very popular.
Yeah. That is for sure. So you don't remember seeing any, I'm not exactly sure, I'd have to have the timeline in front of me of the Brooklyn Football Dodgers, but you didn't see any Brooklyn Football Dodgers.
No. I don't think they were, well, I'll tell you a more interesting thing about it. When you mentioned that, about the Brooklyn Football Dodgers, I didn't even know that existed in full. But anyway, I couldn't become a Giants fan. Because I associated the Giant football team with the New York Giants. And interestingly enough, I became a Browns fan. And they won every year, the Cleveland Browns.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a great quarterback by the name of Otto Graham. And he would pass to Dante, I think, or whatever his name was, their receiver. I was the only person in my neighborhood that was a Cleveland Brown fan. But today, of course, I'm a Giants fan. But I don't root against the Jets. I was rooting for them last night, unfortunately. You know, what can I tell you?
Yeah, I was going by a bar just in time to see the only touchdown drive of the Jets. So that was lovely. Unfortunately, they couldn't come back. But this is obviously a tangent, but they're not. They're not going to probably be that good this year, but, you know, it hasn't been devastating yet, I believe, as some people think it's going to be.
It will be, because they're the Jets, and they haven't won since that miracle year when the Knicks and the Rangers, not the Rangers, but the Knicks and the Mets won. Yeah, so they haven't. And the Rangers came close that year, too.
The Mets Mets, Knicks, and Jets fan. Had it pretty solid in 1969 to 1970, and then one championship later, basically.
That's when I
or
was
two championships later. Sorry, then we had 72-73 Knicks.
But that's what I that's when I was a big fan of all of them.
And
Joe Willie Namath fan, because he really turned me into football. By the way, Joe was out here yesterday golfing with the he had a golf outing at Bethpage. My youngest daughter works at Bethpage, and a lot of old football. She said a lot of old football players and old basketball players, but she called John Starks old. So she's only 21, so maybe that's
right. Exactly.
Everybody's old, you know.
Joe Willie
had a very successful golf outing yesterday.
This will be a good transition back into Brooklyn and baseball. I did find some information out about the Brooklyn Football Dodgers. It looks like by the end of the 40s, there was another franchise called the Brooklyn Tigers, which was the same franchise, but they eventually merged. The two teams eventually merged with the New York Football Yankees. Excuse me. And apparently, it eventually got somehow, according to Wikipedia, it had something to do with the creation of the Indianapolis Colts or the Baltimore Colts.
The Baltimore Colts.
I was just going to say I don't want to get too involved into how they got to that, but go ahead real quick and then we'll move on.
No, I just wanted to tell you what's the interesting part there is that the Yankees became the New York Highlanders in 1903. They were originally the Baltimore Orioles, and they were the franchise. So again, there was a connection. There's always that connection.
Oh, there's all, and especially Babe Ruth, that grew up on the side of Camden Yards.
Oh, I've been there. It's wonderful.
Now, before we go, we have to talk about Jackie Robinson, and we'll certainly get to the movie in a second. But tell me about the impact he had on your rooting, not just your fandom, but also as a person.
Oh, Jackie was he was my first hero. As a matter of fact, when I was in school, I used to draw pictures of people with, and I would color them in. And my mother went up for open school night, and the art teacher said, I don't know, he's good, he behaves himself, but why does he always draw dark people? So my mother said, it's probably because he likes Jackie Robinson.
Exactly.
So, it was a difficult time. I remember an interesting thing about Jackie. I was going to a ball game and got there a little early. They were playing the Giants. And Jackie was a little older then, and he had gray hair. And he comes limping, and I wouldn't go near him. Kids didn't bother them for autographs in those days like they do today. And I was afraid of him, to be honest with you. And he was wearing an overcoat. Oh, really?
No. yeah, disregard her. Keep going.
Okay. So he was limping. So the game starts. He gets a single, or he walked. I don't recall. Next thing I know, he's stealing second. He could hardly walk. He was limping into the ballpark. And, he was just he was my hero. He really was.
That game, tell me about what the game was like after you saw him limping.
Oh, it was a great game. I mean, the Dodgers beat the Giants. I think it was 1954. It was the year the Giants actually won the pennant without the Dodgers, I don't think, had a very good team that year. And it wasn't a great year. It was the year the Giants beat the Cleveland Indians 4 games to none in the World
Series. And they finished second with a 92-62 record in 1954. Certainly nothing to bark at, but obviously not a pennant-winning year.
But the next year was our great year.
Mm-hmm.
We won the World Series. It was like heaven. I mean, it was unbelievable.
Well, really quick, before we get to, before we get to some 1955 talk, tell me about Jackie and what you remember about him from that game where you saw him limping outside.
Well, he played a great game. He was playing, I think at that time, he might have been either left field or third base. I don't recall. And I don't remember much about the game after that. I just thought it was so funny that he was, I'm telling you, he was, I thought he needed a cane.
The first time he got up, though, he stole second base, right?
He stole second base. But, you know, he just didn't steal like they steal today. You know, they take a lead and they fly. He danced mm-hmm. off the base to make the pitches crazy. He used to dance off first base, and he would wiggle and do all. Oh, he was great.
That's what was so lovely about Reyes. Everybody always talked about how, you know, you hadn't people reminded about Jackie Robinson with the way Reyes would tantalize people as a Met. And you're seeing a little bit of that with Eric Young Jr. right now. You know, I'm a really big fan of what he's doing with the Mets right now.
No, I agree with you, but nothing like Jackie.
Hmm.
Of course, I'm old and think that. But, you know, no, Jackie danced. He actually danced at first base. And he would challenge the pitcher to throw to first base. And, you know, the bases are so different today. Those bases used to be spiked into the ground. They were bags. They used to call it the first base bag, the second base bag, third base bag. They're not bags anymore. They just, that's why they, when they slide into them now, there's no give, and they hurt their ankles, the ball mm-hmm. players, or they get all kinds of quad injuries, and we didn't have that.
I also think they're probably working out too much. They might be too tight, or their muscles might need a little bit more time to rest before getting into some of the adrenaline moments that they do.
You might be right. I mean, you know, I remember, the pitches, there was only a three-man rotation, and in between, they would be relief pitches. And there was one game I remember when I think it was in 1951 or 2, it was a road game, and they didn't always televise the road games, and Don Newcomb pitched the first game, and they didn't have a pitcher for the second game. And I read in the paper, I mean, I was a kid, but I read it, he volunteered, and he pitched about seven innings of the second game. I mean, you don't hear that. I mean, come on, these guys, they got 100 pitches, they come at it again. Ridiculous. Ridiculous why they hurt. They get hurt because you're right, they have too many muscles. They never did any weights. They wouldn't allow them to do anything.
Yeah, there was no oblique back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, come on. Those guys smoked. They did everything. There was no drugs. I mean.
Yeah, if you remember in 1961 or the movie 61, Billy Crystal's 61.
Billy Crystal.
But I think Roger Maris was smoking the entire movie.
Yeah, Gil Hodges smoked. Davey Johnson, I think, when he was the manager of the Mets, used to smoke.
Speaking of Gil Hodges, you told me that he had a great knuckleball.
That's what they said. You know, he had a heart attack down in Houston in 1968, and he was pitching batting practice, and he had a great knuckleball. But you want to talk about Gil Hodges. Gil Hodges, when he was in the minor leagues, played shortstop, came to the Dodgers as a third baseman, played third base for two games, went into the Navy, won the Navy Cross, and when he came out after the Second World War, he was a Marine, when he came out, they decided to make him a catcher. So they sent him to the minor leagues to become a catcher. And he did become a catcher, but they signed a ball player right out of the Negro Leagues by the name of Roy Campanella. And Campy could catch. Campy was great. So when Hodges came back, you know, from the minors, they had to find a position for him because he could hit. He was a home run hitter, and they made him a first baseman, and he was a great first baseman. He, you know, you could rave about Keith Hernandez, but Hodges was a fantastic. He would get off before the ball came. He wouldn't stretch until the ball came, so that he can go left, right, or center, whatever he had to do. Today they stretch before the ball comes, so if they throw it a little bit off, an error because they go off the base to get the ball. But he didn't stretch until the last minute. He was great. And I'll tell you another little thing that nobody ever mentions. Bobby Thompson you would have never heard of Bobby Thompson. The hitter before Thompson, I think it was Whitey Luckman, hit a ball that was just out of the reach of Hodges. He stretched, but Hodges was a righty. If Hodges had been a left-handed fielder, his glove would have been on his right hand. He would have got the ball, and Bobby Thompson probably never would have got a chance to hit.
So, but he did.
You don't see too much of that. You never hear anything like that. But Hodges was great. Hodges belongs in the Hall of Fame. I don't know. I won't go to the Hall of Fame because Hodges is not there. I don't understand why. When he left, when he retired from the Mets to become the manager of the Senators, he had 370 home runs, one more home run than Ralph Kiner. And it was the most by a right-handed hitter in the National League history. Of course, it's been passed so many times since then. But at the time, he was the guy. He had 14 Grand Slam home runs. That was the record at the time, and it was a different times. It was you didn't hit home runs like they did in the 90s. I mean, kind of sad that he's not.
Yeah, it's very
and
sad.
And he's
such
a gentleman, and he can play every position.
And plus, what he did for the Mets as well. I mean, by now the fact that the Veterans Committee hasn't voted him in. You know, forget about the writers, the whole logic behind who and what to vote for when it comes to the Baseball Hall of Fame has been askewed and is askewed, and I thought it was certain the last time with Tommy Lasorda on there that Gil Hodges would get in, and you know, maybe he'll be again on this upcoming one, but it certainly...
No, I don't think so. Siva tried to get him in. Siva loved him. He says Siva says that's why the Mets won in 69, and I believe it. Hodges knew every rule, and he got thrown out of one ball game, I think, as a Mets manager. But
I mean, I don't know if you hear more... You know, other championship teams talk about the manager of being the biggest difference maker, like the 1969 Mets talk about Gil Hodges.
Yeah, I mean, Hodges said in spring training, he said, they asked him how many games the Mets were going to win. They never had a winning season. And he said, at least 85. At least 85? What, are you kidding?
And hey, they missed the 90 loss mark for the first time in 1968. So he certainly had some reasons to be confident, and you know, especially if you're grading on a curve. Obviously, if you look at all those Mets seasons being, you know, people were talking about how much when they went from 112 losses to 120 losses to 112. People were like, it's 8 games. It's great.
Well, of course. And there were always more Met fans than Yankee fans in the city.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, I just read this morning, I never knew this, that the Mets actually outdrew the Yankees on the radio. They just watched WFAN, the Mets.
Yeah.
But they actually outdrew the Yankees. So, and that's, you know, only on the – if they get a winning team, they will outdraw the Yankees also in attendance. They've done that. For 12 straight years, they did that. Howie Rose said that in his book.
Mm-hmm.
Put it in the book.
Well, we're running out of time, but before we go, I want to get to some discrepancies you were talking about in terms of the movie 42. You know, I really enjoyed it, and as you said, you enjoyed it as well. But there's little details that you found. Tell us about those.
Yeah, for instance, the scoreboard, there was no Schaefer scoreboard in 1947. Schaefer didn't come in the scoreboard until 1949. And there were other advertisements that were not correct down the lines. And Jackie had this one superstition. He never walked behind the pitcher, the catcher. So if he came from first base and the catcher went to the pitching mound, he'd wait for the catcher to come back into position, and then he'd cross in front of him. If he came from the third base side, he didn't have a problem. They didn't show that, and they had his swing. But what he would always do is, in between swings, he would, practice swings, he would wipe his right hand down his right leg. And that was his superstition. And they didn't show that. And I thought they should have showed. He struggled. I mean, it was like they made it look, you know, they did show some of his struggling, but the whole country at that time was not, and he changed it. I think he did as much for civil rights as anybody. And I told you he was my favorite, and then the Duke was my favorite.
Right, we have just about 5 minutes left, but we can't actually get to the 5 minute mark. Tell me about Duke Snyder and some of your favorite memories of him.
Oh, the Duke, in 1952, my brother, I have an older brother, took me to the seventh game of the World Series. And the Duke, we sat in the bleachers. I still have the ticket stub, and I got the score card, which you couldn't order through the mail in those days. You had to go to the game. And there were guys, with Duke for mayor, you know, all kinds of signs up in there. There were no signs in those days, but that day they were. And Duke for mayor, you know, Duke is the greatest. And the Duke comes up, and I loved him. He came up in the seventh inning. The bases are loaded, one out. And he pops up to second base. He had four home runs, which was a record at the time. He did two World Series. He did that in 52 and 55. And now he pops up. Here's the chance that the Dodgers were losing. I mean, I think the score was 3-2 or something like that, 4-2. Then Jackie Robinson comes up. And this one you've seen, I'm sure, I'm sure you can find it on YouTube. And Robinson hits this little pop behind the pitcher's mound, and Billy Martin comes running in and grabs it off his shoe tops.
Yep.
He doesn't grab it. The Dodgers get two runs that would have went on and won the World Series that year. And that was, you know, that was unbelievable. I met the Duke 1987. He was signing autographs. He got in trouble for that, of course. But, it could happen. He forgot to pay taxes on it. But anyway, I met him, and I had my son Stephen with me. And I said, I can't believe I'm meeting you. After all these years, I said, I told him I used to bat right-handed like he batted left. He had the most fluid swing. He was so graceful. I knew in my heart that Willie and Mickey were better, but he was handsomer. You know what I mean? I mean, I told him that, and he got hysterical laughing.
Somebody on here did one say, "I'm like, I like his face. I don't know exactly what I can explain about it, but I like his face. He was a Hollywood boy. He certainly had that that Hollywood smile."
He did, and you know what? He didn't come from that background. His father worked in a tire factory or something.
He did not come from that.
And you know who his high school coach? He got a scholarship for football, but didn't take it. You know who his high school coach was? Pete Rozelle's father. Just think about that. And Pete Rozelle was his friend. I think they went to school together in California.
Give me context. I'm actually blanking on Pete Rozelle.
Pete Rozelle was the commissioner of the National Football League.
Ah, okay.
For so many years. He built it. He really did most of the building. Anyway, with the TV contracts. And so the Duke, I was taking pictures, and he was charging. You know, people would pay. He said, don't charge these people to me. So I got these pictures with the Duke, and he signed a book, 1952 Dodger yearbook, and he said, oh, you know, and I told him. He was announcing at that time for the Montreal Expos.
We're going to have to take...
The announcer in the business.
Exactly. Well, we're going to have to take a look at some of those pictures at some point. And Alan, I thank you so much for coming on and giving us some Brooklyn insight. And obviously, there's so many other details to talk about, and we'll certainly have you on again. Give my best to your children. I haven't seen them in ages.
Okay. We'll do that. We'll get together.
Absolutely. Appreciate it, Alan. Thank you very much.
I really enjoyed myself.
Oh yeah, it's great. It's always a good time on the Bedford and Sullivan podcast. That's our show, everybody. Take care.